This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Making the world less trashy. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. And here's what's coming up this hour.
A company in New York City has a new approach to the environment to generate zero waste. And we'll show your company how to do the same.
On the tech front, the three biggest mistakes that technology firms are making these days.
A Virginia organization has a clever idea about who else you should invite for Thanksgiving dinner.
And as Frozen 2 debuts in theaters this weekend, where are all the little girls from 6 years ago who loved the movie?
Some of the kids who were the biggest fans of Frozen when it came out are 6 years older now, they're tweens, and they're over it. They're saying they don't want to go, they're being bribed by their parents so that they will go, and the kids have gone on to other, you know, computer games and other shows, and they're just not, they don't have time for Frozen.
Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Gammerman on Generation Frozen, growing up. Law enforcement officials say the gun used in the Southern California high school shooting last week was a ghost gun with no serial number. The .45 caliber handgun used by a 16-year-old to kill two fellow students and wound three others at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita 10 days ago was built from parts that can easily be purchased online. Meanwhile, the incident has prompted calls for the increased installation of metal detectors at schools. Safety experts say that's precisely the wrong response. There's a cheaper, more effective approach, but it's a tough sell. More from Jorge Ortiz, reporter at USA Today. Jorge, what are you hearing?
So one of the things I'm hearing is that metal detectors are not particularly effective in school settings. They may work in other type of settings, but you know, it's too easy to bypass them. They're expensive because they require personnel, you know, an armed guard. And, you know, they'll work in, say, the TSA line. You know, they are people getting paid by the administration, and, you know, they are trained for that. But to have them in schools with the glut that they create, you know, the log jams and the several ways that ingenious students find to get around them is just not very effective. So one of the main things that all the experts agree on is that training of the staff is really much more effective, and it's also cheaper.
And by training here, in terms of training staff, we're not talking about training them with guns, correct? That's somebody's approach?
No. In fact, one of the experts told me that that whole notion of, you know, a good guy with a gun stuff a bad guy with a gun, that's totally incorrect, that it's not effective, that, you know, the more guns you bring into any situation, the more likelihood somebody's going to get shot. You know, there's incontrovertible evidence about that. But the training can take several forms. Some advocate training in assessing threats, you know, checking on students, noticing signs that somebody might be in distress and maybe would take some action, conflict resolution, things like setting up a school environment that's more conducive to people avoiding conflict. Those kind of things, and they're kind of touchy feely. They don't sell really well because it's much easier to tell the concerned parents, hey, you know, we bought all these expensive locks and we invested in metal detectors and we have all these cameras and technology. But they say those are not as effective, particularly because they need to be employed really well, like cameras, for example. You need to have somebody watching and you need to have somebody ready to spring into action. So you have to pay those two people, and also they have to be constantly on alert. So they believe that training personnel is one of the best things to do, partly to prevent these kind of incidents, but also training personnel to take action if those incidents do happen, because they are, to a certain extent, inevitable. It's like you're not going to stop 100% of them.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jorge Ortiz, reporter at USA Today. He's written a piece about preventing school shootings. All right, so this training would involve what?
Some of it is the response training. So if there is an active shooter situation, some of what we saw from the choir teacher at Saugus, knowing to close the classroom, get all the students in, close the classroom barricade. She was trained on helping a student who was wounded, telling them to keep quiet, to turn their cell phones off, those kind of things. So that's part of the training. There are some trainings that are really lifelike. And one of the experts I spoke with, his company is affiliated with an organization that does that kind of training. And part of the argument in favor of that is that it's not just helpful in school settings. It could, these shootings can happen at a mall. They can happen at a Walmart. They can happen at a movie theater. So they prepare people to react in those situations, and they make them very lifelike. And sometimes, some of the argument against them is that they scare the bejesus out of kids.
Yeah.
But once you are trained on those, then, your pulse doesn't race nearly as high as somebody else's, and you're more able to react to those kind of situations that hopefully you don't run into.
What did you mean before? You sort of referenced it in passing, but a school environment that deals better with conflict resolution. Are there such things that work?
I think they do, and part of it is just setting the culture. And it might be something as simple as not allowing incidents of teasing escalate. It's something that happens very, very commonly among teenagers. But, if somebody feels alienated and like an outsider and they get picked on repeatedly, you can see how that something like that could escalate.
Thanks, Jorge. Jorge Ortiz, reporter at USA Today. 13 minutes after the hour.
Around here, everyone knows you need the right tool for the job. It's the difference between orders filled and orders missed, between return customers and product returns. That's why I order from Grainger. With over 250 local branches, will call product pickup, and a time-saving mobile app, it's easy to get it right. When it comes to getting what you need, when you need it, Grainger's got your back. Call, clickgrainger.com, or stop by to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for being with us. As the political intensity ramps up in Washington with the public phase of the impeachment inquiry by House Democrats now concluded, it's probably best to avoid any discussions of the issue at the office. For why, we're joined by Jonathan Bell, employment attorney with the Bell Law Group in New York. Jonathan, why keep quiet?
There's no federal law protections and very few state law protections. So it's a good idea not to talk politics generally in the workplace. Sometimes, for example, if someone says that they're supporting a candidate because of Black Lives Matter, then you could argue that it might be race, which is protected under federal and state laws. But, the First Amendment doesn't cover private sector. It does cover if you work for federal government or local government, but not private sector, which most of us do. So basically, stay away.
All right. So when you talk about protections, you mean if I were to start mouthing off about politics in the office, I could be fired?
Unless you could somehow relate that to either race, age, religion, gender, disability, those protections under Title VII under federal law, then there is no protections. And some companies have policies against making political type statements, and then everyone's an employee at will. You could be terminated for those types of statements.
If you're a manager or an owner or a CEO, I mean, how do you draw up that type of policy?
Yeah, in a handbook. This stuff should all be dealt with in a handbook so everybody's on notice. Now, technically, it doesn't even have to be in a handbook, but at least to give the employees kind of like fair notice of that fact. If it's addressed in the handbook, then there should be no issue. And if there is an issue, then the company can move to termination. Now, interesting, the federal government is the United States' biggest employers, and they do have some protections under the First Amendment. So it's kind of interesting if you are a federal employee or state or local level government agency, there may be some type of cause of action if you feel like you're being terminated due to your political affiliation or making these types of comments in the workplace.
Oh, so protections if you're a federal employee on this type of stuff?
Yes, yes. Wow. The First Amendment basically states that the government cannot go after you for your right to the First Amendment freedom of speech. It just doesn't translate to the private sector.
So
now, places like New York and Colorado, for example, they have some protections of off-duty conduct. So in other words, if I go to a Democratic-type convention, I can't be fired. If it's off-duty, it has nothing to do with my work environment. Okay, but that's here in New York and also states like Colorado. In California and D.C., they literally have laws dealing specifically with political affiliation and discrimination. So in that type of situation, you could start a lawsuit based on state law. You just can't go to district court and file it on the federal level because there are no protections there.
We're speaking with Jonathan Bell, employment attorney with Bell Law Group in New York, talking about why you should avoid talking impeachment politics at the office. What if you're at a company event at a neutral site, an off-campus site?
So it would be more allowable, but like I said, it's at your employee at will. So, you know, I could go and fire anybody in my company because I don't like the color of their shoes. So, I mean, really, let's just talk the ethics of it. We're in a very divisive country right now. And for a company to work well, everybody has to act as a team. So why, you know, forget the legal standpoint, why bring that into the workplace when all of a sudden, you know, some people might feel bullied or harassed or uncomfortable? It just doesn't have a place in the workplace or with your coworkers.
Are we more conscious of this these days than we were in the past? Because it's obviously, as you said, it's so hyped right now.
I mean, I agree with you. It's almost like a natural default to go to because it's all over the news, and people are so passionate with their positions, and when they're passionate about something, they want to talk about it. But what I'm telling people is take a step back and realize how important your job is to yourself and your family, and don't put it at risk and don't put it at jeopardy, because just because you feel that way, that doesn't mean somebody else feels that way. And if that other person that feels differently is your employer and you're now stirring the pot, I just don't think it's worth it.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Bell, employment attorney with the Bell Law Group in New York. 21 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. A New York City company, which operates on a 100% zero waste basis, has become a role model for other businesses that want to reduce the world's garbage. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
You can blame the government or blame big business, but when it comes to producing too much waste, you might want to take a look at yourself. That's the approach taken by a Brooklyn company called Package Free. Ann Cadet of the Wall Street Journal has written a profile about this firm and joins us now. Ann, exactly what does Package Free do?
Well, on one level, they're a retailer. They have a website and they have a store in Bloomsburg, Brooklyn, and it all looks pretty normal from the outside. They sell a lot of kind of eco-conscious products like biodegradable iPhone cases and metal straws. But what really makes them stand out is the founder, Lauren Singer, says that since the business launched about 2 years ago, it has not generated one single scrap of trash.
How in the world have they been able to do that?
Well, a lot of it's recycling. So it's not like they don't generate any waste, but it's all recycled. So they actually have a composting service that comes right to their office to, like, pick up the banana peels. And, you know, when the occasional piece of plastic comes in, they have a special recycler that will take plastics that other recycling companies won't. But they don't have a garbage hauler because they don't generate any trash that actually goes into a landfill. And it's not easy. Not only do they have a pretty good sized staff, they have about 40 people, and there's about 15 people in an office, and then they have a warehouse where they send out all the online shipping stuff, and then they have their store. So there's a lot of little pieces, but some examples of how they eliminate waste or trash is all the boxes that all of their products come into the warehouse, they actually reuse those boxes to send the products back out to customers, and they reuse all the wrapping paper and the packing paper to send stuff back to the customers. In their office, they don't have a copy machine. They don't have any printers. They don't use any paper. Everything is done online, digital. And the interesting part is this actually saves them some money because they don't have to pay for printers, they don't have to pay for copy machines, they don't have to pay for garbage hauling, which costs most businesses in New York City, even small ones, a couple hundred dollars a week. All the shipping supplies, she said, would typically cost her, you know, thousands of dollars a year. She says they've actually come out ahead on going zero waste rather than spending money to sort of indulge in being a good citizen.
We're speaking with Ann Cadet of the Wall Street Journal. Ann, some of those things sound like they would be fairly easy to accomplish, mm-hmm. but some of them don't sound easy. How have the employees been able to adjust?
They told me it when they first come in, it's weird. They're like, where's the trash can? How can you have an office without a trash can? And they're pretty strict when employees come and join the firm. They're issued a metal lunchbox and a thermos and a water bottle so that they don't, you know, bring in any trash to the office when they bring in their lunch. And there's a list of approved lunch spots that don't, you know, deliver food in plastic containers. But I have to say, anyone who goes to work for this company, they're already big environmentalists. They already care about this stuff. So I got the impression that most of them are pretty happy to, you know, spend a little extra time to do things the zero waste way. I think a lot of them aren't really thrilled about washing dishes in the sink down the hall, but I think they feel these are sort of minor considerations. And a lot like the founder, Lauren Singer, they feel like if you are going to expect other people to care about the environment, you have to start with yourself.
And Anne, were these ideas all Lauren's, or is it a group effort now?
So a lot of these things that she's introduced to her businesses are things that she figured out on her own first before she started the business.
That is Wall Street Journal columnist Ann Cadet with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. If you've ever stood in the men's essentials aisle looking at every size and shape of socks and underwear, you know it's overwhelming, right? Which brand, which style fits you the best? You never really know. I just buy something, usually take it home and put up with it. But that's all changed thanks to Mack Weldon. They're reinventing men's basics, engineering their own fabric, then meticulously designing everything they make to fit me right every time. They apply the same smart design to their website, too, to make it easy, even fun, to find the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, and more that you've ever worn. Their winter selection is amazing, too. I have a pair of Ace sweatpants. I just lounge around in on the weekend watching football. Mack Weldon is more comfortable than what you're wearing now, and they want to prove it. Get 20% off your first order if you visit MackWeldon.com and enter the promo code Gordon. If you don't like it, you can return what you got, no questions asked. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code Gordon, for 20% off your first order. Mack Weldon, reinventing men's basics. Thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, are you burning out at work? You might be addicted to the word yes. Also, Generation Frozen is growing up and families inviting shelter dogs to Thanksgiving dinner. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. By one measure, there are three major things wrong with the tech industry. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group, says technology firms should be cooperating, not competing, when it comes to the issues of sustainability, diversity, and security. Rob, how do you see this?
The various technology companies are using them to define competitive difference. In other words, regardless of the OEM, they have efforts that are focused at recycling things, certainly efforts and focused on creating more diversity in their company and the rest. And the issue here is when you're talking about something like sustainability, it's all about saving the planet. And here you would think, or at least what I think, is that you should have more cooperation between the companies to make this happen. And the end result is then one company learns from the other, designs change, and you make much more progress. Now, in fairness, with sustainability, that is happening to a certain extent. For instance, HP and Dell are actually cooperating with regard to technology, much like Mercedes-Benz does with safety technology, where they offer up whatever they create as a free license to any other automaker that wants to use it. This should be the same thing for sustainability, and we're seeing it with companies like Dell and HP. When you come to diversity, one of the big issues the industry has right now is if a manager has been misogynistic, abusive, or whatever, they lose their job at one company and they end up over at another company where they abuse the employees over there as well. And so my view is those employees should be flagged. I mean, we should either, you know, correct the behavior or manage them out of the industry. We shouldn't be playing a game of hot potato with the bad managers, because it's causing the problems to spread. And then the last thing, of course, was security. And with security, we're facing an unreasonable amount of threat right now, government-level threats. Some of the projected serious problems are, for instance, if the power grid goes down for an extended period of time, some of the forecasts are we'll lose about 85% of the people. That's 85% of the people dead. So there is a severe problem with regard to the fact that no technology company can stand against China or Russia or North Korea by themselves. This is another area where we probably should have an awful lot more cooperation, and particularly have the government much more heavily involved, because we're talking about an existential threat. And so in all three cases, that rather than using it as competitive differentiation, use it as a collaborative effort to improve the overall safety, health, and environment, depending on whether you're talking about sustainability, diversity, or security.
Revisit sustainability, because to a certain extent, consumers play a role here, right? I mean, this was a Wall Street Journal story I read the other day, which just talked about, hey, you know, when you order from Amazon, that sweatshirt, and you want it delivered the next day, usually that one sweatshirt gets delivered by a single truck, right, in a box, there's probably much more efficient way to do that than reduce your carbon footprint.
Well, yeah, I mean, and some of the Amazon stuff is pretty bad, because you not only get one box, you get a box within a box, and they're shipping you a sweater, which makes no sense. So they're getting better, though. They're starting to put that soft stuff in plastic bags instead of in boxes. I think Amazon kind of gets that they need to move the ball forward, and there is a process whereby you can send the packing material back to them for recycling. I don't know how many people use it, but you're right. The consumer in that particular case would have to participate in the program, because you're still throwing the box out as opposed to sending it back to Amazon for recycling. Or with regard to HP, HP is a huge program for recycling ink cartridges for the printers, but if you don't send the cartridge back and instead you throw it out, and the envelopes, by the way, send it back are free. You can get those from HP, and then you just put it in the envelope and put it back in the mail. And then they'll fully recycle it. They pretty much recycle everything in the print cartridge, but the ink. They haven't figured a way to recycle the ink, the leftover ink, so it gets rid of contaminant. But they're keeping it. The unscrew thing is they're keeping it with the hope that they'll be able to figure it out later, or put it in another use, like use it for coloring posters or something where the tolerances are a little less.
Right.
But you're right. It really requires for sustainability. It really requires the customer to participate.
Thanks, Rob. That's Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Coming up next, one of the main reasons you might be burning out at work. Thanks for being with us. The statistics on workplace stress are pretty staggering. According to the American Institute of Stress, 83% of U.S. workers suffer from work-related stress. Why so many of us? Dr. Ivan Meisner joins us now to go in-depth on stress and burnout. He's author of a book on personal behavior called Who's in Your Room? Dr. Meisner, what should we know?
To some extent, stress is dependent on whether you really love what you're doing or not. I mean, sometimes if you hate what you're doing, it's a lot easier to get stressed out than when you love what you're doing. But in either case, sometimes we just say yes too much. You know, yes too much to a good thing can still be stressful.
Yeah. Why are we that way? Why do we say yes so much?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that at work, we want to be a superhero. We want to make sure and do everything we can to move up in the organization. I think another thing is we just don't like saying no. Most people don't like saying no, and they don't know how to say no. They don't know how to say no without sounding like a jerk or worse. And people don't like sounding like a jerk. So what we wanted to do is to try and figure out a handful of ways to say no without sounding like a jerk.
All right, so give us a couple. How do you do that?
So here's my favorite one. I'm going to start with my absolute favorite one. It's the one I use the most, and it goes like this. Gordon, if I said yes to you, I'm afraid I'd let you down.
Ooh, good one. Put it right back on me, right?
Well, it's like I don't want to let you down. Now, you use that when you mean it. I mean, for all of these, you got to use it when you mean it. And so if you've got a relationship with somebody, you really don't want to let them down. And the beauty of it is you don't even use the word no.
Yeah,
I didn't
say no.
I don't want to let you down. You say, if I said yes to you, I'm afraid I'd let you down. And people, they usually get that. And, you know, you usually have to follow it up with why. My bandwidth is overflowing. I've got too much on my plate. It's not really my area of expertise. Mm. You know, so that's my favorite one.
We're speaking with Dr. Ivan Meisner. He's the founder of BNI, a networking organization, also author of a book called Who's in Your Room? And we're talking about stress and burnout at work. What's one you recommend here where you say, don't Seinfeld it? What do you mean?
Yeah, I love the don't Seinfeld it. So one of the really funny things about the old TV series Seinfeld is how the characters would go off on some crazy subterfuge or complicated ruse that ends up getting them into more trouble than if they'd just been candid in the first place and said, no, I can't be there, or yes, I did that, or whatever. They would just make up stories. And so I urge people, be honest, be direct, be gentle. But don't Seinfeld it. Don't make up stories. And you can tell people are Seinfeld it when they start giving you a list. Well, I can't do it because, you know, I've got this issue and this issue. And I forgot to mention my cat needs a whiskerectomy and, you know, all this stuff. But really, just say no.
Thanks, Ivan. Dr. Ivan Meisner. Again, the book is called Who's in Your Room? It is 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Now that Human Resources Director Fernando Pino has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, he's completely crushing it. He even has his own hype song.
Supporting our entire workforce, everyone has different hours, skill sets, and pay grades. Motivating and engaging our people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger. I'm on the top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the
top, I'm gonna rise up. I'm on the top. Thanks for joining us. The Disney sequel Frozen 2 hits theaters this weekend, but many of the young girls who fell in love with the first one are now tweens and not so much into princesses anymore. More from Ellen Gammerman, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Ellen, set this up.
Some of the kids who were the biggest fans of Frozen when it came out are 6 years older now, they're tweens, and they're over it. They're saying they don't want to go, they're being bribed by their parents so that they will go, and in some cases, it's the moms and dads who are going without the children because they just feel nostalgic about it. But the kids have gone on to other, you know, computer games and other shows, and they're just not, they don't have time for Frozen.
I thought it was interesting. You quoted a woman who studies this stuff, and she said Disney princesses are being outgrown more quickly. Why is that?
Well, she had a couple of reasons for that, but one is that we're talking more about princesses, and parents are talking to their children about princesses, and there's awareness that there are other kinds of things you can aspire to be in life, but also there's sort of a double standard, she argued, because superheroes and Star Wars and all that stuff, little boys, and, of course, girls can hold on to into adulthood and go to those big Marvel movies, but the interests of little girls are very quickly discounted.
Wow. But wouldn't there, so if there's concerns about, say, falling in love with Frozen, I mean, wouldn't the next generation of young kids want to be watching this and kind of carry that same enthusiasm?
Yeah, they probably will. It's six years is a bit of a wait for a sequel, for the original fans.
Okay.
This is going to be a huge movie, there's no question. And a lot of those young kids, as you mentioned, are going to be pouring in. And there's tons of merchandise, and it's going to be the whole Disney phenomenon, or it's certainly predicted to be. These slightly older kids who would have died for a sequel, several years ago now are just kind of meh. And it's just such a, six years is a lot to wait for a sequel, but it's also, think of everything that happens in a little girl's life age 4 to age, 10. There's a whole lot new, a whole lot of new perspectives and interests and kind of attitudes coming in.
We're speaking with Ellen Gamerman, arts reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her piece is called Generation Frozen Grows Up, as Frozen 2 hits theaters this weekend. You got some great quotes from some of these kids too. And even some of the parents. What were they saying?
One girl said she'd rather be watching YouTube in her bedroom. She really likes nail art videos, so she'd rather see that than Frozen 2. And this is a girl whose father spent $250 at the Bippity Boppity Boutique in Disneyland to give her a Princess Elsa makeover. Sorry, Queen Elsa makeover. And so this is like, this movie had been so central to the lives of some of these families, and I think that's really where some of the craziness comes in, because these girls had been living, breathing this movie, singing the songs all the time. It's such a 180 from where they had been.
All right, thanks, Ellen. Ellen Gamerman, arts reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Don't forget, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly as well on Twitter at Gordon Deal. You can also friend us on Facebook. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Here's a fantastic story for you animal lovers. It begins like this. No one should have to spend Thanksgiving alone, especially shelter pets. TheDodo.com says that's just the thought that came to the mind of Christy Chips Peters, shelter director of Richmond Animal Care and Control in Virginia. She put a call out to the community 4 years ago, and before she knew it, 35 animals were out of the shelter and on their way to spend Thanksgiving with generous foster families that year. And more than half of those animals that year were adopted. Nowadays, the number of pets who have plans for the holiday has nearly tripled, thanks to an overwhelming number of people who take part. Ms. Peter says the shelter provides the supplies you need, like medicine, crate, food. And the following Wednesday, the pet comes back. But the shelter makes it really easy for people to keep that pet forever. If families do choose to adopt the pet they host, the shelter waives the adoption fee, as you might imagine. Oh, and by the way, she says it's not just the animals who end up benefiting from the experience. Hint, hint. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.